Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And speaking about guests, I have in the studio with me a dear friend, Anne Marganow. Anne, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks, Armand.
Oops. There we go.
Good to be with you.
Yeah. Anne, the reason I asked you in here today is because we share something in common. Not only the type of work that you do, which is to help people with emotional expression, which is what I find is your extraordinary talent, and but also the attitude you have towards people and the way that men feel safe in bearing themselves with you, in letting you, letting themselves be who they are. And it's really, that's where my curiosity is, because I know you are a very mature, although very beautiful person, you know, who's been around here a long time. But in general, whenever a man has seen you as a therapist, you know, they've seen you and they say, she's a remarkable person and I feel free to be myself with her. So there's a respect that you have for men and their minds that manifests in your work. And I was going to ask you to talk about two parts of this today. One part is, what is the deeply emotional work? And then about your relationship with men in general.
Well, the deeply emotional work is helping men through different techniques, which we will be talking about, to access their softer, deeper feelings that they, most of the time walking around, do not feel that they can exhibit. And in order to do that, you have to have an innate trust of whom you're working with. And that's what I work very hard to achieve, is that rapport, that bond, so that they can safely access their deeper feelings.
You have to have a deep trust for anybody you do that with.
True.
Men will have that with men very often. But, you know, the fact that men, and I want to say, of course, Anne works both with men and with women, but it's kind of remarkable that she has a high ratio of men, which most therapists have mainly a high ratio of women patients. So mm-hmm. Do I. I have a high ratio of male patients. So let's go back to this, men and their softness.
Mm-hmm.
So you're turning all men into wimps.
No, not a bit. Not a bit. What I believe is that I connect with their softness as well as reassuring them that they still have whatever toughness and resilience that they need to manage in this rough world. But they need a safe place to feel, just as women do. And that's what we hopefully provide.
A safe place to feel and their softer feelings,
mm-hmm.
their more tender feelings, such as what? Fear?
Yes. I believe that there's a great deal of fear that most men carry around, probably unconsciously. They're not aware of it. But that they carry around because they have to be so tough. They still feel they have to be more competitive than I think women often feel. They're still more hierarchical than women. And I think that this is an issue for most men. So it's a great relief if you can share with them that they can access their softer feelings.
It's always nice for someone to lecture to you. You know, I've seen for years men saying, yes, 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 women all want us to access our softer feelings because they don't want us to be who we are. But you're saying, no, 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 it's for you to access your softer feelings so that you could be who you are. Because we as men have been taught these softer feelings don't have much room. We don't have much room for them. We don't even have a design for them. We don't have a menstrual cycle. We don't have
mm-hmm.
we don't have things, hormones that are rushing through us that are telling us, feel these feelings. So what's the advantage to feeling them? Why feel sad? Why feel scared? Why, if I don't?
Well, it's a question of integrating oneself. And I think that if men are cutting off those softer emotions, it shows in their relationships with their girlfriends, their wives, their children. I think it leads them unnecessarily to a lot of anger, because that's the safest and easier emotion for men to access. And they get stuck with dealing with anger as opposed to the myriad other emotions that they truly do feel.
If you don't feel safe feeling other feelings than anger, then everything will kind of appear as anger or repression. Now, I think it's a very interesting thing.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Hogan might. Do you know Peter Hogan?
No.
Anne, I should let you know that Anne and I have known each other for over 30 years, and we've trained in the same neighborhoods, right?
We did, in the same hood.
the same. We've kind of been part of the same organizations, which really has always been go for the gusto.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our kind of training has been reach in there. I remember Peter Hogan. I'm going to mention Peter. Peter used to take people down to their deepest, most primal feelings. And I remember as a trainee, I was passing him by as a student of psychology. I heard someone who I knew was a woman who was psychotic. Hmm. She was screaming in a room somewhere. And I said, Peter, how could you have her do this screaming? And he said to me, what are you afraid of, Armand? You're going to drive her sane? It was a very good point, because that's exactly what happened to her.
Really?
Through what Peter said was that all insanity, all anxiety, all disturbance, mental disturbance, is a result of a feeling that was afraid to be felt.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
And this is where we go. If you're afraid to feel it, and therefore what we would do or what you would do is guide a person to any feeling that they would not feel, that they were afraid to feel. Why should you live if you have a reluctance to feel something somewhere, like if you're afraid to feel fear? Well, if you can't feel fear, then what levels of safety are you going to allow yourself to challenge in your life if you don't have a safety, if you don't have a fear factor, if you don't let yourself feel sad? What risk are you ever going to take with losing something? How attached are you ever going to be?
Not very.
So the idea is
to take, I would say, any route in, whatever is the most accessible to the person I'm working with, is the way that I will go, knowing that inevitably we will get to the fear, because that's what's stopping the emotion from being processed.
But sometimes, Anne, people have stories to tell you. And they tell you stories, and these repetitive stories block any access to the feelings because they're just stuck in the stories. They want to tell you stories. Like, they go to a therapist, and they tell the therapist, oh, today my boyfriend laughed at me, and he yelled at me, and I'm mad at my boyfriend. And it goes nowhere because it's just a circle form.
Mm-hmm.
How do you step out of that verbal, repetitive, going nowhere kind of rhetoric?
I think you need to change the scenario, and you must stop them from telling the same old story the same old way.
Could you describe how you would stop them?
I would try a technique in which I would take a patient such as this and have them stop talking and have them perhaps lie down, do some very deep breathing, release their bodies, let the couch support them, for example.
What couch?
The couch that's in my office, that they would come in and lie on, because they will be less defended if they lie down and breathe as opposed to telling me the sob stories. Now, quite often that will release feelings for people, and they'll start to get in touch with some older feelings that are obviously from childhood or some past experience. Sometimes it doesn't work. In a case like that, what I would do is have them use their voice to talk back to the feelings that they are avoiding.
Now, this is a very interesting concept, hard to describe on radio.
Mm-hmm.
How do you talk back to voices? People are always talking back to themselves in their head,
mm-hmm.
and that gets them nowhere. So how do you manifest this so that it becomes a transformative process rather than just a ritualistic, repetitious process?
Well, I might get them to play the role of a critic of theirs and put themselves in, let's say, a chair or at the other end of the sofa and talk to that
What do you mean put themselves in a chair?
Take that part of them, imagine it. Imagine themselves sitting in the chair and making, turning themselves into a critic of what those feelings might be. So, like, why are you always telling the same old stupid stories, and why are you so frightened, and why are you so stuck? And then I would actually get them to switch sides, so to speak, take the other position, and talk from that poor me victim voice, the storyteller, and say how terrible it feels to be so stuck with
all. Can you give me an example of that? Let's say, why are you always so you have, let's say you're playing both parts, right? So let's say it's Anne goes into a room, right? And she plays both parts of being Anne, the criticized and Anne the critical?
Correct.
What would critical Anne say to criticized Anne?
She would say, stop whining, stop telling these ridiculous stories over and over again. Get up, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, do something.
And what would the other Anne say?
Then I would say, I can't do it. It's too much for me. I need help. I'm drowning.
And at what point, what would happen then? What would you...
Then I would fall into my sadness and truly feel how helpless that I
do. So you, the therapist, would guide this patient, Anne, and you'd say, okay, Anne, you really feel powerless.
Yes.
Move into the powerlessness.
Correct.
Now, this is what we spoke about last week, which I call dislodging. Mm-hmm. It's a new word. I made it up just now. And I think you'll find it interesting. I believe that we have things lodged inside us. And my image of this, even though it may not be perfect, is of a colon. You know, I keep hearing about Majita Lee talking about cleansing the colon. And I think about there must be things lodged in the colon because there are so many different areas in the colon that things could get stuck. Like, you know, an old coin from childhood and a ring and stuff like that, that if you did something, it would probably all come out. Or there's stuff around your heart, or there's stuff around your liver that's lodged in there. It's just caught in the side, and it gets in the way of your natural functioning. The question becomes, how do you dislodge it? What do you do? Like in nutrition, we know that if you clarify your diet, if you get rid of some of the trans fatty acids, if you do things like that, you could, in a way, make a path that makes it more conducive for this stuff to move. That's one, easing the way, you know, oiling the road. Another way is to shake it loose. A shaking it loose might be screaming at the top of your lungs and just shaking your hands and fists. It's all an attempt, and I believe all of this cathartic kind of emotionalism is an attempt to dislodge this junk that's caught inside us. Now, among the junks that get caught inside of us are these kind of aberrations of emotions. They're not really emotions. It's like an aberration of an emotion. It's like I have a feeling, but the feeling's turned into a thought, and the thought is turned into another feeling, and it all turns into a piece of black coal that's sitting on the inside of my heart. Mm-hmm. And what it takes is it takes someone like you to say to that person, you see that feeling that you're afraid of? We're going to go there. We're aiming right for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it reminds me of some tough business women that I worked with in the 90s. Very high achieving, very tightly cinched waist, very high heels, very kind of cut off, shallow breathing. And I came across a theme which I thought was fascinating that I think I heard three or four times from the same women, that they're terrified of the bag ladies in the subway stations and terrified of losing it, so to speak, and becoming a bag lady. And what I worked with was the idea that maybe it would be very freeing to let go. And let go of all of it, of the money and the status and the we're having to work so hard and compete with men. And these were mostly Wall Streeters, so they had a lot of pressure. And every time it would release a torrent of sadness and relief to imagine that they could stop, just stop emotionally. What drives people is that they can't rest because they have to keep moving, keep avoiding the feelings, keep running for success. And when they stop, they can truly feel who they are. And it was a theme. I thought it was very interesting.
Very interesting. So very often with people, if we could get to a point, we could say, look, you're on this kind of treadmill.
Right.
We have to dip, we have to stop for a moment, and we have to get off the treadmill. And wherever we stop, we have to visit this feeling. The many feelings that people are terrified of, you know. I have a sign on my wall. You probably see it right in front of you. It says, it's only an abyss.
I do see it.
It's only an abyss. Because part of what happens when you've denied a feeling for so long is it seems like the feeling is endless.
Yes.
Now, pain has a definite advantage. Pain is definitive. It is, you can tell how much pain you're going to feel. You know the limits of your pain.
Mm-hmm.
There, you can only feel so much and then you pass out. But that's physical pain.
Right.
Emotional pain seems limitless, and it seems like we're going to lose our mind or somehow everything is going to fall apart, which is always an illusion. Because the truth is you're going to find your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole idea of having this chaotic breakup in your mind that doesn't come together, which usually comes from people who are overwhelmed by feelings that they don't feel.
Yes.
This is not people who are overwhelmed by feelings that they do feel. Hysterical people,
mm-hmm.
people who are at loose ends, are not feeling, even though they seem like they're screaming and yelling. They're not feeling. They're avoiding feelings.
Right.
And that's what we see with hysteria. We see the avoidance of feelings.
Yes. In fact, with hysterics, what they are trying to do is enlist external help with all of their problems, as opposed to just feeling the real feelings that they have and understanding that they have self-support. But in order to find self-support, you have to go down into the deep feelings. It is, however, a great relief when you do it. And you find self-support that you did not know that you had.
You know, I often wonder what the end of a therapy session should feel like. Most people go to therapy, and when they walk out, they kind of feel blah. Well, that was nice to talk to my therapist. It was blah. My belief is that you should walk out of a therapy session, and you should feel like you did if you went into physiotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
I grew, and it's only, I think, the challenging work that helps you grow. Mm-hmm. So beyond therapy, even day-to-day life, even people listening now, what are the feelings that people fear that they would feel? And we're going to talk about some of that. A little later today, we're going to be taking your telephone calls as well at 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. We'll take your calls. And rage. Somehow, with almost every man I ever find who is afraid of his rage, I find a little boy who was told that if he ever becomes too aggressive, his mother won't love him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, he is told that he has to take his aggression and put it away somewhere, or mommy's not going to love him anymore. Then he comes to you, and by the time he gets to you or me, he comes in saying, I don't know what's happened to me in life. I can't progress in life. I can't advance in life. And I look at him and I say, well, you seem to have had an angerectomy. You seem to have had an aggressive ectomy. It looks like somebody took out of your spine all of your ability to aggress. If you're not allowed to get angry, then you can't be aggressive. If you can't be aggressive, then you can't move forward. Aggressive doesn't mean hurting people. It means moving forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, we have to reclaim your aggressive self. Now, of course, when they do that with me, this is a man with a man reclaiming mm-hmm. his aggressive self, and that's always acceptable to men. Well, with daddy, we could be aggressive, you know, man, 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 man. But when they do it with you, or they do it with Aura, or they do it with any of the other therapists who I've seen do this work, something remarkable happens because now the rules are changing. Now they are being aggressive with mama right in front of them. They are being there now in front of you, allowing themselves to feel the rage and despair that they were never allowed to feel. And I believe that if they could feel the safety with you, that makes physiological, psychological, long-term changes.
I agree. And it's that acceptance of finally having it be okay that they show a full range of emotion. And they often, as they will be working with doing with the anger techniques, such as hitting or yelling or stomping around or whatever we...
Well, we have to add some pronouns there. Hitting you?
No.
Hitting themselves?
Hitting a pillow.
Hitting the secretaries?
in their fantasies. Doing hitting of a cushion or a sofa with the aim to release the anger. And as they do it, they often will check you out to see what your facial expression will be, of course. Check you out to see, am I okay? Is this all right? Is it okay if I do this? And, of course, that's the trust. And if you're sitting there calmly with them and letting them just have their feelings, that's very freeing and energizing for men like that.
What do you feel when you see that happening for the first time? When you see a guy... and he's been repressed, and he's been a good boy, and he starts letting this happen, and he checks you out, is it okay?
Mm-hmm.
What do you feel inside? I mean, I know you're acting very passively and saying, well, it's all right. You feel the joy of watching somebody?
I do.
Tell me about it.
I do. I really enjoy doing that with men because I think they find so rarely they can do it, the sort of good boy type guy. And once they get in touch with that power, which shows on a lot of levels, they feel much better in the world. They feel better with women. They're not as afraid of breaking into a rageful state as opposed to just being angry, which they're becoming entitled to. So it's a wonderful feeling.
People should understand that when you begin to express aggressive emotion in a therapy session,
mm-hmm.
it does not carry to the outside where you become explosive. It's the opposite.
Right.
It's the explosivity outside that comes as a result of not being able to have a place where you could feel it.
Absolutely true.
So you don't become more explosive on the outside. Yet one of the things that people tell themselves is, if I ever let myself feel my anger, I would kill somebody.
Yes.
And that's a message from mommy again. Mm-hmm. That's one of those messages that your parents put in your head.
I agree.
You know, if you ever let this happen, you're going to kill somebody, you're going to destroy somebody. Mm-hmm. We don't kill each other.
No.
At worst, we get mad at each other.
Mm-hmm.
But being able to tell somebody that you're angry with them when they do something that hurts you is the only way to true love. It's the only pathway to loving. Because mm-hmm. if you can't tell somebody what they do that hurts you, how could you love them?
Mm-hmm.
How would you get to know them? How would they
That's
get to
true.
Know you?
Very true. And for these this sort of personality, these quote good boys unquote, they're very very afraid of that because they have to stay close to mommy and they have to do what they're told. So they carry around a lot of rage, as opposed to someone who can express anger freely. You know, it's fascinating to watch this. Men, on the whole, work in a more direct fashion. They tend to go from A to B to C, and the tracking is a lot of fun because you explore it with them, and they get to be, as we call in therapy, seen, I mean acknowledged and on that level. So that means acknowledging in every feeling state and having it be okay that you see all this. It's a deep release.
And it's a beautiful thing.
It is.
The one of the things that I told someone today was I said, you know, you're going to do this deep feeling work, but I said, I'm not sure how your relationship is going to fare after this. A lot of people get into relationships as a way of repressing their own emotions. So if you find a relationship with somebody who is not accepting your feelings,
mm-hmm.
then you base your relationship on the suppression of your feelings. Now let's say you go and you say, but I don't want to live this way because it makes me depressed. And you begin to change and you become from being a passive, person who never said anything, who never objected to anything, you start to feel your right to be alive and your right to be more aggressive. You may turn around at the end of that and look at your partner and say, wait a minute now, I chose you because I needed somebody to hold me down. Now I don't need anybody to hold me down anymore. I wonder what I saw in you in the first place. And I find frequently, mm-hmm. unless the people are growing together,
right.
that the relationship that seems so appealing at the beginning doesn't become appealing at all. Do you see that happening?
Yes, because they've gone from getting the other person to act out certain emotions for them to internalizing their own struggle and working on their feelings themselves. So you don't need the other person in the same way. And if they don't adapt and change with you, yes, you could have a breakup. It could be the end of that relationship. For example, if a good boy decides to, and I've been dealing with this recently, decides to quit smoking and tells me that he knows all these feelings are going to erupt when he does stop smoking, and indeed they do, and he just recently told me he's sick of being a good boy. And I went, aha, now the world's going to change. I don't know what his wife is going to think of this. I don't know if he's going to want to drive the church van anymore or do mm-hmm. one of the many myriad responsibilities that he's supposed to attend to every day.
And on some level, the mate mm-hmm. is dying for the person to be free. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like parents of children. You have your children are depressed. You look at yourself and you wonder, what did I do to make my kids depressed? And then the kids rebel. And the kids start fighting back.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, wait a minute, why don't you appreciate me? Can't you? But on some level, as a parent, you got to be happy that your kid is striking out for themselves.
Yes. I think you are, because they can't grow up otherwise.
And if you make room for your new partner, the beauty of it is, if you have an adult partner who does decide to make change, you get a whole second chance. See, even you as a mate get second chance. You get a new mate. It's like you're having an affair. It's like, who is this
person? That's a great way to see it.
Who is this person that's coming in here? This is Armand DeMille. I'm with Anne Marganow. Anne and I know each other for a number of years. Anne is a specialist in helping people release deep, repressed emotions. That's what she works with primarily. And her specialty, although she works with both sexes, is she seems to be able to work with men in a way that really frees them to be themselves. Now, I know men therapists who do that, but I haven't met many women therapists who empower men the way you do.
Hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
But you made a comment earlier that men trust you. And I wanted to follow up on that by what is the mechanism there? Because not a lot of men compete.
Yeah.
I mean, their bond is through competition, and yours seems not to be.
I understand. That's a very good question.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. All I know is that I have such love and respect for most people I see, but the men in particular always seem lost.
Do they?
Yeah, they don't seem to be a decent dad in town. Hmm. You know, not one that could really say, okay, son, let's really take a look at the depth. So I feel that I have this great respect for men, no matter who they are.
Hmm.
And I think that must be conveyed. Look, we have to take a short break. I'm going to address that question when we come back.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
Good. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends. Just a teaser. Nice, huh? Hey, Anne Marganow, Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind. Okay, let's talk about trust of people in general. One of the things I like about you, Anne, is that you have you have this kind of conviction to your quality of your work. You don't believe in, you know, in just doing things to do things.
No.
You have to feel good about yourself.
Yes.
And we have to also say that we've also had on the air with her Eric Marganow, who is your husband and partner, and Eric is a dear friend of mine as well. But the quality of the work that you do, the essence of it, this intensity of it, what keeps you doing it? You've done this now for 40 years?
Mm-hmm.
How many years have you been?
I would say 35.
35 years.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. What excites you? What turns you on about it?
What turns me on is the immediacy of working with deep feeling. I'm always going for a result. That's what propels me forward. I'm not content to just show up for the sessions. So the thing that keeps me intrigued and attached is engagement. I refuse to do sessions in which I don't engage with the person, even if they're negative and reluctant. My job is to find a way in and to find a connection. And then I feel that the technique is only part of it. It's mostly how they connect with you. If I can find my way in to make a real connection, then the work begins.
So your intention is always there.
Yes.
It's so easy to get sloppy.
It is, and that's when you get bored. So if you don't let yourself get sloppy, and you're always looking for the way in, and that is your job, then you don't get bored and you stay engaged.
Hmm.
I mean, each person is like a puzzle. So that's how I see the work. And also, frankly, I love the results with deep feeling work. You go further, faster. And people tend to hang on to what they work on, as opposed to some therapies where I think you have to be told by the therapist over and over again, you're okay, you did a good job, you this, you that. You begin to be able to tell yourself. In fact, if someone says to me, well, I already heard that your voice in my head, I said, good, the therapy's working. Now you're owning the therapy. And you will hear my voice when you're 100 miles away. It really doesn't matter. It's yours.
Because they're going to hear your voice guiding them to their true feeling, as opposed to hearing their own voice, because you've been there, you know, and you will tell them, okay, can you feel that any deeper? Can you take that down to its source?
Right.
Can you move into that feeling?
Mm-hmm.
So you're sitting there, you know, I call myself a psychodetective.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting there, too. I'm like a raven, you know, looking for where there's going to be food.
Uh-huh.
So when people come to see me for the first time, and this even happens when I interview people on radio or when people call in during a show, I'm looking and I'm saying to myself, okay, where is that sparkle going to be? Where's that tear? Mm-hmm. Where is that smile? Where's that thing that no one's expressing? And being a fortunate person, I'm fortunate that I have the sensitivity to be able to pick up on it. At a distance, on the radio, you know, I could do it here. But then when I see people in person, that's what I'm looking for. So people hear they hear me by reputation saying, you know, well, Armand, you go into Armand's office and immediately starts you screaming or yelling. No, I don't do that. I have so many different things that I might use, but I'm always like you. I'm looking for the moment.
Yes, you're looking for the thing not said.
And what happens with therapists in general is they get bored, especially in-network insurance-providing therapists. I wonder what they call that. You go into an office, you sit there, you talk for 40 minutes, and the therapist is really not working. They're really just collecting the in-network fee. They're not actively searching. They're not hungry. They're not striving for.
There you go. It's the active. Yes. That's what keeps you engaged.
Yes.
We're active partners in the room.
And you're actively working, and you want to work.
I do.
If the person wants to come in and talk to you about their boss and complain about their boss and not do anything, what do?
I use it as a jumping-off point. In fact, that's a trait with most men. They will usually start with work. It doesn't mean we'll finish there, but that's what we start with because that's what they're comfortable talking with. And it will be like carrying on about their boss or their secretary or whatever's going on in the room. That's fine. That's fine because we get to the deeper feelings that drive that. And for men, as we know, they're on the whole, the stereotype, as terrified of being deemed incompetent. And it's different from the way women operate, which is that women are terrified of being killed. I mean, we operate very differently. So once I got that concept...
Wait a minute. Let me get that concept again. Mm-hmm. How do you see the difference between the men and the women? The men are being deemed incompetent?
That's one of their biggest fears.
Hmm.
Women are... It's our place in society and who we are in general. I think we're afraid of men or afraid of being killed at the strongest level. But what I often say to women is, you humiliate a man at your peril. Because for them, I believe, this feeling of competence, of being able to go slay the deer or do whatever big job they have to do, is they probably put that ahead of anything. So I think men suffer a great deal more when they do feel humiliated, ashamed, which is probably why they're afraid to access their softer feelings, because this is one of the things that might come up for them. That's why it's critical that they feel safe and approved of by the therapist.
By you?
Yes.
By you. But it's also critical that they eventually get that from their mate.
Yes, it is.
So how do you affect that when you're working with just one of the partners? You have to get the partner to be able to bring this material to their mate and say, this is what I need of you.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. In other words, if he's going to stop being a good boy, that's a huge challenge to his wife, who's used to having everything her way for all these years, and he's going to have to confront her and be a man. And see what happens. I'm thinking that she'll kick and scream for the first while and try and reassert the system. But if he persists, as you say, I believe she'll be deeply relieved that he's a free man as opposed to a good boy.
Because it helps both of us grow.
Yes.
It helps us both grow. I don't want you in that role. I don't want you to be in that role. And I'm sure you don't want to be in that role either.
Right.
Speaking with Dr. Ann Marganow, who does intense feeling psychotherapy, merely meant to elicit the deepest feelings from people, and we were talking about the work with men. So back to just for a moment, the men's needs.
Yes.
To get underneath this stuff. If they do it, and they could feel the full range of feelings, including sadness, including fear, none of it cripples them, because one of the things that you do, and I know you do, is you take a person not just into sadness, but into the depth of sadness. Not into anger, but into the extension of anger, to full-blown rage. Not only into fear, but into terror as well. Could you describe how you might do that?
Again, I might get the person to act out both states of being. And even if they are not in touch with that in the moment, the action of taking that, acting that out, would likely get them more deeply into the feelings that they're avoiding.
So if a person just simply says, I'm afraid, and then they repeat it again, I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid, mm-hmm. I'm afraid, and you let their entire body collapse around this word, I'm afraid. And they're saying it over and over again, I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid. It actually begins to bring a growing terror, and you can feel the fear, and you feel yourself regressing, and you feel yourself going back in time, and now you're a little boy saying, I'm afraid, where you were never allowed to say it before. And you are actually, by going back in time, you're actually changing the programming in your mind that says you're not allowed to do this.
Exactly right.
And going into the depth of that abyss. Now, when you go all the way in there and you get down to abject terror,
mm-hmm.
fear is nothing. It feels like nothing by comparison.
That's correct.
Once you've known the whole way, you know, the partial way doesn't hurt at all.
Mm-hmm.
Once you know what it's like to have pain all over your body, you know, just stepping on your toe is not as bad.
Yes.
So that's in dealing with terror. There's another feeling mm-hmm. that men I think, are really reluctant to feel. And I don't know how far that you've gone with men going there, but need. The feeling of needing someone. The feeling of saying, I need. I need you. I need you. And really feeling the fear of the person leaving you.
Mm-hmm.
You work with that?
Yes. If someone's going more deeply into their fear and they begin to become terrified and regressed, and their language will reflect that. They'll start to talk more simply and just sort of repeat the words. They won't be explaining or doing any of that mind work. They'll be just feeling. What I might do, even though I don't know whom it's connected to, it's always connected to someone, as we know, I might perhaps take a pillow and put their arms around it and just see what reaction I might get. That's a pretty reliable thing to do, as well as work with the breathing. And that pretty much always will get them more deeply into the feeling.
So you have them embrace a pillow.
They do.
And you're saying, I need you, and they're embracing this pillow. But we don't know who that is that they're saying it to.
We don't need to know. They will tell us. It's been my experience that I'd say, we don't need to know this yet. We'll get there. And, of course, probably in 5 minutes we know who it is. Pretty reliably. They will tell us. We don't have to put words into their mouths. That's when the feeling process just takes right over. And whenever it is really going on in a room, whomever is there is paying rapt attention, because it's the primary, it's the bottom, so to speak. That's what I call the death layer, where people are terrified of dying, being abandoned by their parents or not having enough to eat, or being dropped off somewhere and not picked up. I mean, all of these things that we've all experienced, they'll go straight into that feeling, and they will know where they are. And they will also probably know their age.
Hmm.
I mean, I'll say, how old are you? 3. Just like that. Haven't thought about it. It comes right out. I had that happen the other day. And I had put a pillow in his arms, and I just watched him go into the feeling. And it was not, I didn't have to do anything but be with him. So that's how I would handle that situation.
So when a person does get into that death layer,
yes,
that's a curative spot? Is that the spot where you reverse things?
Yes. I believe that's where we really feel that we're not going to live through it. And therefore, that's why we resist it and do all sorts of trickery to not get to that feeling. But I tell people, honestly, it's a lead-up that's so hard. Once you're actually in that layer and you're really just feeling, you don't care about anything. You're in the moment. You're in the present. The relief of releasing and finally letting it just be is not only healing, but the body knows it's letting go of some terrible block. You were talking about blocks earlier. The body knows that. And there is a great, it's fascinating. You can sort of watch people alternate between being in despair and joyful at the same time, flipping back and forth, because the relief is so real and they've been hiding it for so many years.
We focus mainly on men.
Yes.
Let's talk about your work with women, too, because I know that's the other part of your practice, of course. What issues do you find that women have to most deal with as far as their repressed emotionality goes?
Well, they have trouble feeling powerful. So they come at it, I mean, men act out being powerful in the world, and for the most part, women acquiesce or work around, shall we say, fit in. Very hard for women to take a direct route to things. And often if they do, they're criticized as being too masculine or too much, and other unflattering titles. So I would say to get in touch with their power is a big thing for women.
But, well, you know, here again, I got to go with this one.
Mm-hmm.
You're quite an interesting combination of this, because you have your own power, but you're certainly not what anyone would call masculine.
No.
If I searched for it, I would find it. I would find your aggression, and I'd say, oh, look, she's got her own amount working.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't feel like a lack of identification with your own womanness, and yet I guess you're an ideal image of what it would be like for a woman to have both power and softness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know you can't talk about it, but I could say it from what I've always known about you.
Mm-hmm.
There is no part of you that's afraid of the world. Well, there must be parts of you that are afraid of the world. But even dealing with your fears, you deal with your fears, right?
Pretty well. Mm-hmm. But again, I think that's what I bring into play when I work with men. I don't think they feel I'm competing with them or emasculating.
Mm-hmm.
And men pick up on that, as we know. It doesn't even have to be a verbal message. It's just sort of in the air, that hostility or that emasculating quality. And if you're not putting that out to them, they're wonderful, gracious, great guys. They want to do for you, I have found. And that's part of the competency that I've been talking about.
What is that thing you said about at your own peril?
I say you're putting a man in a terrible position if you humiliate him. Gratuitously, or even not gratuitously. It's just a very, very bad thing to do. And you talk about no dads, no good dads. Well, I would say it's these emasculating mothers who make their sons feel like they have to stay good boys their whole lives. And therefore they can't admire their masculinity and enjoy it.
So as a mate to someone that you, a man or woman, that you humiliate, that you in some way bring and say, here, look at yourself and admit and tell the truth what a bum you are. A man could be saying it to a woman could be saying it to a man. You may get the person to actually admit and say, yes, I'm a bad person, but you do it at your own peril.
Yes. You lose them. You increase the damage. And you lose them because they inevitably will be feeling revengeful and want to get you back. And what's the point? That's where we lose each other. So it just doesn't work as a technique, battering people down.
What's been, I know this is not one of your favorite areas, is working with couples. And I want to talk about that for a moment because I can understand more. Because in your book, you're looking to see people manifest their own individual powers, but you must be terribly, I would say even worse than wary. You must really dislike the mind power games that people go through during even a talk therapy session, which is basically tell her she's wrong and tell him he's wrong. Mm-hmm. And they do that with you. Now, there, you can't go for the emotion. There, you're looking at two people doing silly things, fighting over toothpaste covers. And the stalker you, the raven you, sitting on the branch waiting to find that speck of emotion that you're going to pull on, it has no room whatsoever in a room like that filled with all kinds of words that have no meaning.
Unless you can find a way in. The job is then to find one area of vulnerability, one person able to take the step of changing the script, so to speak, the practice going over whatever they do, and say it differently. Which, of course, we know changes everything in the room when that happens. And if you have that sort of breakthrough with people, you actually can do very good work. It's just as if you're being pummeled by two. It's a two-for-one thing, so it's a lot harder. They're just more difficult sessions, and you really have to be on your toes. And you've got to find a way in, or you could be doing the same therapy with them 2 years later. He said, she said, basically.
You know, we've only got a few minutes, but it reminds me that the person who did some of the most beautiful work with couples was Alan Diane Pezzo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, yes.
See, I knew I'd brought a smile to your face.
Yes.
Talk about them for a moment, your experience with them.
Well, they complemented each other for sure. There was a situation
perfect,
yeah. Where there was no competition, so they were very powerful together, and yet very vulnerable. And I particularly liked the way we worked with them, and you were part of that scene too, in which we would enroll different people in the room to play different characters in their lives: grandfathers, parents, husbands, wives, and so on. And it was a fun technique.
fun technique.
Absolutely fun. Wish we could do it all the time. It's kind of labor intensive, but it gets results. Because for the first time for some of these people, they get to be the director of the play. And they get to tell everybody in the room what to do and how to act and how to say it and where to sit. And the power in that and the sheer joy that a lot of people get from being able to direct their own play, so to speak, is a lot of fun and very healing. I remember those days fondly.
Gee, do you think if we could dig back and find enough stuff, maybe the three of us, you, me, and Eric, could do a workshop together, and we can invite people to come to a couples workshop a la Peso.
Oh, that would be fun.
Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be a kick.
We need a huge space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but a big, big room.
A big, big
and
room.
And quite a few people,
uh-huh.
And let the action begin. I have found it to be one of the most dynamic things that one can do. It never became trite.
Yeah.
It was always exciting. So that's a cool idea.
Yeah, nice idea. See,
we
only want to do things that are exciting.
That's for
sure. At this point in my life.
Yes.
Don't give me any repetition of the same old thing. That's why I'm not doing lectures.
Mm-hmm.
People ask me all the time, when you come and do it, I say, oh, my God, they're so boring.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The same lecture, the same words over and over again. Give me something challenging. Give me something new. Seeing people for the first time, that's always new and challenging for me. I like that a lot.
And you're very good at it.
And working with you, Anne, has been an absolute pleasure, especially recently as we've gotten back together, because I finally feel that there's somebody out there who's talking the same language. You know, I mean, Stephanie Don was certainly great, and Ori Amini Morrison, who works with me, but this is, it's like at this area, I just think it's so great to have you here when you get here. Now, Anne, you could reach Anne Marganow. It's Margenau, and you can go through my website, thepositivemind.com, or send me an email, and I'll forward the email on to her. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed myself.
We have so much more we have to cover, you know? So maybe we'll be doing this again real soon. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here at WBAI 99.5 FM. We're talking about the importance of repressed emotions. We're not saying that all emotions should be expressed all the time. Actually, we are saying that. But things that people call emotions, such as rage, that's not an emotion. That's an expression. Anger is an emotion. Expressing anger never results in rage, because rage is the extension of it where you don't feel it. And depression, that's not an emotion. That's an absence of emotions. But sadness, that's a feeling. That's one that we want to talk about. So trying to separate between the two becomes very important and very interesting and a learning technique. And Anne, I want to thank you very much for being with me and helping us sort it out. So, my friends, we will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we have a little more of this very fine stuff to continue with. This is Armand DeMille. If you want to get in touch with us, you can go to thepositivemind.com.
Yeni bolo e bukinde bwemba bo Woko 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 Lende wa Woko 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 Lende wa Nimana siden Tunguda kapa mbola wa.
Do you know that you can donate to WBAI anytime, 24/7, 365 days a year? You can do this by going to WBAI.org and click on the support section on the right-hand side of the homepage. You can also donate during business hours Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. by calling 212-209-2800. Thank you for your continued support.
Creative Unity Collective, alternating Friday nights, midnight to 3. WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Once upon a time when we were colored, stolen from the mother. 400 years later, Mr. Charlie's on some other. Take this as an affirmative act, to slap back the whack. Catch brothers, sisters who were falling through the cracks. Creativity and unity, the keys to maintain our humanity and our sanity. No vanity, materialism, big willy crap. Just progressive elevation, can I get a soul clap? Keep it going on. CUC, keep it going on. Keep it going on. Creative unity, keep it going on.